I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. Families are still making the difficult and dangerous journey across Central America to ask for asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border, in spite of efforts by the Trump administration to deter them. The zero-tolerance policy separating children from their parents has been rescinded, but the message is still the same: stay home. Last year, President Trump called Syrian refugees one of the great Trojan horses and instituted a travel ban to keep certain asylum seekers out of the country. Even under the most welcoming environment, it's not easy for someone fearing persecution in their home country to have their case heard and be granted asylum here in the United States. Well, today we want to clear up some of that confusion and describe the process and the people looking for asylum. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Ayodele Gonzalo. She's an attorney with Hyas, Pennsylvania. She's also secretary of the Philadelphia chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And she's an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law's Transnational Legal Clinic. Ayodele Gonzalo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. David Glosser is with us as well, and he's a retired neuropsychologist. He used to work at Thomas Jefferson University. He now volunteers with Hyas and with Physicians for Human Rights. He wrote a column for Politico that caught our eye about a month or so ago titled, "Stephen Miller is an Immigration Hypocrite. I know because I'm his uncle." David Glosser, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for inviting us, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Adele, let me begin with you, because I think there's confusion about refugees, undocumented immigrants, asylum seekers. We tend to sort of mix them up or consider them all of one large group. What does it mean to seek asylum in the United States?
So I just wanted to, I would just explain that there is a difference between asylees and refugees. But the criteria for determining who is which is the same criteria, essentially. It's just about where you're applying. So refugees would apply for protection when they're outside of the United States. And those who are in the United States would be considered asylum seekers until they're granted status as asylees.
So they have to get to the United States first.
Yes.
And then ask for asylum.
Yes.
And people have the right to ask for asylum.
Yes, it's enshrined in the statute. And the statute also says that it doesn't matter how you get here, whether you get here legally or you walk across the border undetected. It's very clear in the statute that you can claim asylum.
What's the criteria?
So the asylum statute is really enshrined from international law. And it requires that someone demonstrate that they are outside of their country of citizenship or nationality, and that they have a well-founded fear of persecution, and that they are unable or unwilling to avail themselves of protection from that country. So that's the general language that we use when we're talking about asylum or refugee status. The actual process is very convoluted,
yes,
as you can imagine.
Yes, I got the feeling.
And it's also very, you know, it's forms based and very fact intensive. The application process is you complete a form that we call an I-589. In immigration, we use lots of numbers and
acronyms.
Yep. Yes. So you complete an I-589. That form itself, I would say, is not very clear. It doesn't allow the applicant to really explain their case because of the way that it asks for specific information. And so when we at Hyas are preparing an application, we will complete the form, but we'll also add an affidavit, a detailed affidavit statement from the applicant that explains the life that they had before they experienced any problems, the problems that they've experienced, why they think that they have experienced those problems, what they think might happen to them if they were to be returned to their country of origin. So that's the the beginning process, but then we also have to be able to substantiate that.
Sure.
Right? And certainly we have to substantiate the fear that the person is going to, that they believe that they're going to experience. And so we work in partnership with other professionals. And because I work for a nonprofit organization, my clients are indigent, so they don't have the money to pay, often don't have the money to pay professionals. And so we work in partnership with people like Dr. Glosser, who are very generous with their time and talent. And so I will refer a client to him, and he will do a psychological evaluation so that I can provide evidence of the subjective fear that my client's going to thinks that they will that they have, and then on top of that, we also do research on country conditions to provide objective evidence that this fear is reasonable.
Well, David Glosser, let me get you in on the conversation. So it's your job to determine the psychological state that a person seeking asylum is in or has left behind.
Roughly, that's correct, Marty. My role in this, in part, is to elicit history from people who have suffered often extreme traumas, prolonged tortures, deprivations, murder or rape of loved ones, etc.
It's a painful conversation to have.
It's a long series of tragic conversations to have with people. This is material that oftentimes the attorneys are not equipped nor professionally trained to deal with, and so they seek professional help from a cadre of psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, and other physicians.
I'm curious about, you're talking to someone who's a foreigner, a stranger in a strange land. They don't know you. Mm-hmm. How do you begin to elicit some of that information?
First thing I do is I ask them if they'd like a cup of coffee. Sit down, take it easy. Let's talk a little bit.
Does it take some of the chill out of the air?
Yeah. About the worst thing you can do is to bring them into a formal sterile exam room wearing the white coat and start with medical interrogation. The idea is to provide, first of all, a feeling of comfort and safety and to outline the parameters of what's to take place. And just as you would welcome a guest into your home, you want to make them feel at home and comfortable and safe.
And are there certain questions that, I mean, you wanted to, I mean, sort of hard, cold facts is you need to determine whether they meet this criteria for asylum.
That's right. After the, and you have to also bear in mind that quite often I'm having to do this through the services of an intermediary translator. Many of the folks who are coming to see me, people from different countries of Africa or Central America, do not speak English, of course, and my foreign language skills are limited to rather rudimentary French and rudimentary Spanish. So we're having to deal through with a third party and sometimes two translators, so the examinations can take a little while. And in order to perform the examination, once they're comfortable, you have to start to elicit history.
And some of this history is really, I mean, I've read some of the people that you have described and what they have endured in order to seek asylum in the United States.
That's right. Yeah, so I gave a brief description of that in my political article, which I take it you've seen.
About a man named Joseph.
Yes, that's not his real name, but that was the pseudonym I attributed to him.
Who was tortured and imprisoned and starved.
Well, he'd been recruited at age 14 against his will and against his family's will to be a child soldier in the endless Eritrean-Ethiopian conflict, which has only recently started to come to an end. This was almost 20 years ago now.
Right.
He was dragged out of school, hauled up hours away from his home to a military training base. Along with a lot of other child soldier recruits. And sadly, the officers in charge, after he'd been there for a few weeks, discovered that he had his family had given him a Bible as a gift to comfort him during the course of his training. And his officers discovered the Bible in his bunk, and they concluded that he was a member of a forbidden sect. They thought he was a Pentecostal Christian. Mm-hmm. He actually was a member of the Coptic Church of Ethiopia and Eritrea, the dominant local religion. But the officers decided to make an example of him, it appears, and he was subject to prolonged torture.
Yeah, it was horrifying to read.
Yeah.
He's in the United States. He got asylum.
Yes, it was a long, dangerous trip for him. He had been subject to continuous torture for 20 days of an extremely brutal and degrading nature, at which time afterwards, in a state more dead than alive, he was thrown into a prison cell with 36 other young men who had been similarly subject to abuse and kept there. He was there for roughly 19 months, and there wasn't enough room in the cell for people even to lay down. They were starved and beaten. And he eventually contracted a serious disease and was taken out of the cell and taken to a medical clinic about an hour or two away from there. And fortunately, he started to recover and was able to escape from the medical clinic and was picked up by a driver who took him into Sudan, where, again, at age 14, he began his journey to try to save his life.
Yeah, ideally. Let me turn back to you. And I mean, that's absolutely one horrifying example. There's so many different stories of people seeking asylum. And again, I think there's a feeling from some that they're faking, they're making these stories up, they just want to get to America, turn their back on their life.
Well, there are some people that you're never going to dissuade from that view, but certainly from the work that I do and the people that I see, I know that there are atrocities that are occurring and that people need to be protected from. Dr. Glosser mentioned one. The other case that he referred to in his Politico article, that woman was my client. The backstory to that was that even though they're Yemeni, the family had been living in Saudi Arabia as guest workers and with few rights. And she and her sister were,
it's upsetting.
It is upsetting. I mean, especially as a woman. But sure. They were attacked by men who were trying to rape them. And even though she was fortunate and had not been violated, but the whole process is a violation, right? And on top of that, the response of her husband was not very helpful. I mean, this is a very conservative culture. And from his point of view, his wife was tainted. And so rather than help her to get psychological help to be able to deal with the trauma that she had experienced, it was more of a shunning and more of a focus on, well, how can I protect my property and make sure that no one else gets to experience her in the way that I do? And so then he was insisting that she be circumcised. Mm. Circumcision happens not just in Saudi Arabia, it happens in Africa as well. It's a very traumatic procedure, often done with blunt instruments, done at different ages, done to babies, young children who can't speak out, to women. I actually represented just recently...
We've got to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about what it takes to seek and get asylum here in the United States. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with David Glosser. He's a retired neuropsychologist who volunteers with HIAS, also with Physicians for Human Rights. And Ayodele Gonzalo is an attorney at HIAS Pennsylvania, both of them involved in assessing the needs and the life story of people seeking asylum here in the United States. Ayodele, you were talking about a woman that David had actually written about who was in dire straits in Saudi Arabia.
Right, and I was actually transitioning to just explain, I represented a woman from Liberia who, she's my age, right? I won't tell you how old she is, but, and so she was actually working in an organization that was trying to promote women's rights and to prevent the circumcision that occurs in Liberia. It's part of a initiation process for some tribes, not for all tribes in Liberia. And when she went into a particular area in the rural area of Liberia, The women there obviously did not approve of the work that she was doing. Right. And so actually they abducted her and four other women, and they circumcised them. And one of the women who was circumcised died of blood loss, you know. And the client that I dealt with, not only did they circumcise her, but they marked her on the back with all this. It's horrific scarring. So there is tremendous suffering that occurs and that we deal with in terms of those who are claiming asylum. And what I would also just add, and I didn't sort of include it in terms of the definition, you know, when you're applying for asylum, you have to show that you are going to be persecuted for one of five reasons, because of your race, your nationality, your religion, your membership of a particular social group, and also because of your political opinion, or because of your political opinion. So it's not just because you want to come here. There are very specific
things.
Yes.
Let me go back to you, David Glosser, and actually go back to something that you wrote in Politico. Again, the headline, Stephen Miller is an immigration hypocrite. We should know he works for the Trump administration, part of the White House staff. I know because I am his uncle. And you write about the fact that, like many families who immigrated to the United States, your family used chain migration, bringing other family members over. And you write, I have watched with dismay and increasing horror as my nephew, an educated man who is well aware of his heritage, has become an architect of immigration policies that repudiate the very foundation of our family's life in this country. Using your family as an example, and I realize you're a neuropsychologist, but I'm not going to ask you to diagnose your nephew. But nonetheless, why do we struggle so much with immigration and people seeking asylum?
Well, if you take a look at the example of my family, let me give you a little bit of the background on that. My family originated, as far as we can trace back, in part of the former Russian Empire, which is now in the country of Belarus, from a small town called Antipol, a little townlet in the middle of nowhere. My ancestors there, my great-grandfather was dirt poor, you know, chickens in the kitchen kind of poor. And lots of kids, some of whom survived to adulthood and some of whom didn't. At a period of time when the Tsarist government was engaged in a program of vilification of Jews and support of random violence against them and organized violence, and also of kidnapping of male children for forced conscription into lifelong service in the army, which was often a death sentence. Our family, like millions of others in that region, millions of other Jews, determined that there was really no sensible future for them in that part of the world, and they sought to get out.
Right. Came to the United States.
Came to the United States. And so my great-grandfather came over following his older brother. After my great-grandfather's name was Wolf Leib, came to the United States. He did sweatshop work for a while and was able to round up enough money to bring over the rest of the immediate family, which happened in 1906.
Right.
And
this is how many families came to the United States.
You know, sometimes I give lectures on one subject or another related to this, and last week I gave a talk about this subject to a crowd of about 100 people, and I asked And before I started the lecture, I asked everyone in the room who was an indigenous Native American to raise their hand. There were none there.
Right.
So the rest of you are immigrants, or the children of immigrants, which was, of course, true.
Well, and you go on to say, I shudder at the thought of what would have become of the Glossers, that's your family, had the same policies Stephen so coolly espoused, the travel ban, the radical decrease in refugees, the separation of children from their parents, and even talk of limiting citizenship for legal immigrants had been in effect.
Well, this is not a theoretical question. We know exactly what happened to those people. Our family, there were 74 of our family that we were able to trace back who did not come over in the early 1900s. In 1925, rather, an Immigration Exclusion Act was passed in the United States, barring the entrance of principally of Catholics from Southern Europe and from Ireland, and also of Jews from the Russian Empire. So the 74 that did not come to the United States or managed to escape to other countries at the close of World War II, all of them had been murdered.
Right.
Of the
died during the Holocaust.
Yes, there had been approximately 2,000 Jews in Antipol at the time of the outbreak of World War II, at the end of the war, only seven survived. Mm. So it's not a theoretical question what would have happened to them. They were all murdered.
Is that the situation we face today?
I hope not. you know, just yesterday, the administration said that it's proposing to reduce refugee numbers to 30,000, which is the lowest that it's ever been. You know, for organizations like mine, where we were established in the 1800s, specifically to resettle Eastern European Jews, you know, during the pogroms.
If I can interrupt for a moment, I'd like to mention also that Hias was instrumental in helping my family to be settled in the United States. Right. And in fact, in my great-grandfather's will in 1927, Hias was the highest among the list of bequeathments that he made in his will.
It meant that much, yes.
There's that relationship. And the work that we do now, we still resettle families, I mean, from all over the world. But the refugees that are coming from very specific countries. And even though the numbers are 30,000, it will be significantly less than that actually come.
Because of just the bureaucracy?
The bureaucracy, the deliberate slowdown in processing people to come to the United States. This year, the numbers, the ceiling is 45,000. At the moment, just over 20,000 people have come, and the fiscal year ends at the end of this month. Ah. So you're not getting another 25,000 people in. So there's just an orchestration of attacks on immigrants on many different spheres, both the undocumented, those who are legally allowed to come to the United States. There's just this incredible attack, and I think it's just shameful.
Why do you think? I mean, and we're not the only country that is struggling with this issue about refugees and immigrants.
Look, the United States can't solve all the problems in the world, but we're hugely influential, we're hugely wealthy, we're large, we have a big population, we're extremely good at absorbing immigrants, as we've proven over the last couple of hundred years. I had, over the summer, I spent a bit of time in Jordan, and through casual conversations and discussions with folks there who are in positions to know, we find a country that has absorbed somewhere between 700,000 and 1.5 million Syrian refugees who are fleeing from one of the greatest conflagrations and most horrible wars since the end of World War II. Jordan, you should know, is a nearly landlocked country. It doesn't have enough water even to supply its own basic needs, and has a relatively small population and a tiny economy. Yet they are and Syria is not a natural ally of Jordan, by the way.
Fraught part of the world, to say the least.
It's a very difficult part of the world. And Jordan and Turkey and other countries, Uganda and other countries, are being asked to carry the burden of relief of the terrible refugee crisis that's been occurring in Syria. There are many other examples I can give. The United States, for its part, has done very little in order to help alleviate this. Now, I'm not proposing that we admit every person who applies, but we can use our resources to provide both help to solve the basic problems which are causing these problems, and we can also give help in proportion to our ability and our wealth and our size and our expertise in order to help folks.
That's David Glosser. He's a retired neuropsychologist, and he volunteers with Hias and Physicians for Human Rights. Ayodele Gonzalo is an attorney at Hias, both of them involved in asylum seekers and helping them navigate through the process. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Email from Stu, who says the legal roadblocks are used by the Trump to mask and excuse racism. It all starts with that. Do you see it that way, Ayodele?
So what I will say is that the statute is written colorblind. The application is not that at all. And so you will see that even from the the State Department when people are applying for visas. There are people from certain countries who are unlikely to get a visa to come. There's an assumption that if you are of a certain age, male, your only desire is to come to the United States and to stay. Those who, I mean, if you think about it, even in the statute, there's a provision that says people from certain countries don't even need a visa to come to the United States. Guess where they're from, right?
These are fast-tracked.
From, you know, European countries. So right there, there's the notion that if you're white, you don't have the desire to stay in the United States, and that's absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there is a complete imbalance in terms of how the statute is applied.
I mean, David, we were talking about this before going on the air. We are a nation of immigrants, a cliche that still has some kind of meaning. And at the same time, we have a history of not welcoming immigrants to this country, whether they're Jews or they're Irish or they're Italians or they're people from the continent of Africa
or Chinese.
I'm just saying. So here we are again, in many ways, struggling with this issue of immigration and identity and strangers coming to our country.
The decisions about who to admit to the American polity, the people who are entitled to have full citizenship and to vote in the United States, is a long and sordid history. We've made a great deal of progress over the years, but it has been very fitful at best. If we look back into the early days of the Republic, the first substantial laws regarding immigration came with the Chinese Exclusion Act of, I think, 1882. Which was a deeply racially motivated definition of who was allowed to come into the country and who wasn't allowed to come into the country. When the United States needed huge immigration in order to farm the fields and man the factories and provide the labor and so forth, the gateways were opened, mm-hmm. and people came flooding in from the distressed countries of Europe as well as other places.
This is
our history. And then there's the other story of immigration, of course, is the people who were migrated here against their will, the millions of people that were brought here as slaves and kept in positions of servitude and defined not even as full human beings in real reality until the Civil Rights Act of the late 1960s were passed. So all of the immigration policies and laws all occur within the context of the economic and the political conditions of the times in which they occurred. As I said earlier, in 1925, the so-called American firsters of their day, and that's exactly what they called themselves, went on a rampage of a campaign to vilify and dehumanize people coming from Europe as terrorists, as drunks, as idiots, as lunatics, as criminals, as gangsters, etc., in order to justify excluding them. Yeah. And now, very disturbingly, we see that the President of the United States is based as almost as the onset of his political career on the same premise of falsely claiming Barack Obama to have been a foreign-born Muslim, something that he was very reluctant to finally acknowledge was untrue.
Devi, let me turn to you. And under the Trump administration and under Attorney General Jeff Sessions, some of these categories have been reduced or certainly – if there's a question about gang violence or domestic violence, that is not considered a criteria for getting asylum. How much does that change the work that you do?
It changes it significantly. And what I will just say, Marty, is that, yes, the Attorney General did issue a decision. The battle over that is not over. It will be challenged. Because there are real questions as to whether or not the Attorney General can simply say that there is a category that does not qualify for asylum. That is not what the statute says. You're supposed to do an individualized assessment mm-hmm. of each person's application. So, with respect to the domestic violence issue, the Attorney General is suggesting that this is private violence. And really, this is
as opposed to political violence, I guess.
Right, exactly. But it's also a way to attack women, right? Because women are the ones who are more likely to experience private violence, but they're also the ones who are more likely to not receive protection from their governments. And the statute or the laws require us to look to see, is the government unable or unwilling to provide protection? Hmm. And if you can establish that, then there is the possibility of the person qualifying for asylum. So I think we have to look at it at the with the lens of the political views of this administration, the wider political views, and it's not just with respect to asylum and immigration. I mean, it's with respect to so many things, and in many ways, women are under attack, and this is just another one, another way.
I'm curious about just the process, how, assuming someone starts making that asylum request, how long generally does it take to get that asylum?
So there are two ways that you can apply for asylum. You can apply for it affirmatively, and that's when you are making the application to the Immigration Service, and it's to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. And they now have a policy of the last applications that they receive are the ones that they will interview first. So I have people who filed back in 2015 who are in this black hole, and goodness knows when their applications will get processed. But if you file an application recently after January, you can expect that they're going to interview you within 6 to 7 weeks. And then 2 weeks after your interview, you are required to come back to the asylum office to receive a decision. And in most cases, that does happen. Right. The Yemeni client that I have, she was interviewed in December and was still waiting for a decision.
And
so it doesn't always work that way. And the other way that you can apply for asylum is defensively in immigration court. And right now in Philadelphia, our judges are giving us individual hearing dates in 2020, 2021.
And meanwhile, they wait.
They wait.
Well, we have to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you. Ayodele Gonzalo, thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you very much for bringing up this topic.
You're very welcome. She's an attorney at Hyatt, Pennsylvania. David Glosser, thank you for coming in as well.
Thanks for inviting us. It's an important subject.
Absolutely. He's a retired neuropsychologist who works with Hyatt and Physicians for Human Rights. We're going to take a very short break. We've got a third guest waiting for us. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were just talking about what it takes to be granted asylum in the United States, and now we want to focus on the children who have been separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. Earlier this year, the Trump administration instituted a zero-tolerance policy that led to the separation of thousands of children as a form of deterrence. That policy is no longer in effect, but still left hundreds of children in shelters and foster homes not knowing where their parents are. We asked Lee Gallern to join us. He's an attorney and the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants Rights Project. He's also an adjunct professor at Columbia University. Lee Gallern, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So how many children have not been reunited with their families or their parents? Do we know?
We estimate that there's about 400 now who are still not reunited, which is very difficult to believe this far out, but that's the reality.
I mean, do we know where those 400 children, even if their parents don't know, do we know where they are?
Yeah, at this point, we know where the children are, and we've slowly begun tracking down the parents. We have made contact with all but about 60 parents now, so that is really heartening. Going forward, we think that, you know, there may be an end in sight, but it's taken way too long. These kids have just been languishing in these facilities all by themselves, and I think at this point most people know that it wasn't just older teenagers who were separated. It was even babies and toddlers. And so there are still little children sitting by themselves without their parents for months on end.
And one can only imagine being a 16 or 18-month-old, not having seen your mom or your dad for weeks or even months, what that means for that little child.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things we're seeing is some of the younger children don't even recognize their parents when they're brought back. The other thing is that the children, the younger children, are so resentful and angry at their parents, understandably, because they're just too young to understand that their parents couldn't stop this, but all they feel is this anger and resentment toward their parents. Why did you let this happen to me? But, of course, the parents are equally traumatized, could not stop. But the parents had to sit there, sometimes in handcuffs, and watch their little children be torn away screaming, "Mom, Dad, please tell them to stop. Don't let them take me." And the parents were helpless. I mean, what the medical community predicted and the evidence they put in our case is that these children may very well be traumatized for the rest of their lives. I think what's going to happen is a deep-seated vulnerability is going to set in. One of the families that I've talked to, the mother said, "Well, my child is back. He's 4 years old. He's back after months of separation, but he still asks me, are they going to come and take me away again?" I think we've done real damage to these little children.
Now, the courts have gotten involved, obviously. Isn't the government in essentially the defiance of the courts? It said these children have to be reunited with their families.
Right. So we brought this lawsuit way back in February and March before even the zero tolerance policy was formally implemented. And then it exploded. The court has ruled, fortunately, that it's unconstitutional to separate these families and that the government has to reunite all these families. And that's been happening. I think the government has made excuses about why they can't give us information, why at almost every turn they're fighting us. But I think now the court has finally put its foot down and said, here's how the reunification has to happen. And so we're on track now, hopefully, to reunite these families. But there is a danger that we don't find some of these families, because the last families we're talking about are parents that were deported without their kids. So the parents are now somewhere out there in the world. Their kids are back in the United States, and we've had to track the parents all over the world. There's about 60 we haven't been able to track at this point. Hopefully we will find these 60.
The government argued that the ACLU could use its quote-unquote considerable resources to locate those parents, and it sounds like the ACLU and others have done that, correct?
We have. We had no choice. You know, the government tried to wash their hands of this and tell the court, look, let the ACLU find these parents. But the court fortunately said to them, look, you created this mess. You separated these families. You deported the parents without the children. You are not shirking responsibility. The ACLU has said they will help. Give them information to help. And so we brought in other groups, a law firm called Paul Weiss that's done incredible work, NGOs called Justice in Motion, KIND, and the Women's Refugee Commission, as well as many other NGOs working on this. You know, at the end of the day, it should have been the government doing all this work, but we're not going to sit around while these children are suffering and not go out and find the parents. So that's what we've had to do.
You were in Guatemala recently. I saw an NPR story about you. Literally, what, looking for parents who were perhaps looking for their children?
Yeah. So we went and it was partly to try and find parents we haven't been able to contact yet, but also just to talk to the parents we've only had brief phone conversations with to understand what exactly happened to them. And the other thing is I wanted to be there to see what the human rights defenders, the local human rights defenders on the ground are doing to understand the logistical obstacles they face or any other obstacles they face, and so to provide them with additional resources. And, you know, we met with fathers in particular, and it was just agonizing for them to have to make this choice of, am I going to leave my child back in the U.S. Right. to pursue asylum, or am I going to have my child come home and potentially face a danger? And what we're finding is a lot of parents are just making the brutal decision to leave their child in the U.S. because they just feel it's too dangerous to bring their child home. You know, and that's a choice you would never wish on any parent, to have to either choose between safety or reunification of the family. And so that's what's going on now. It's just a horrible situation where these families are separated but ultimately may choose not to bring their child home because it's just too dangerous.
Because of what, gangs, criminal gangs that might either
I think,
target them?
A bunch of different things, including gangs. And so, you know, one father we tried to visit, we couldn't visit during the day because his employer wouldn't let him off work. But then the father said, you can't come here at night. I'm not even allowed out of my house at night because the gangs impose curfews on the whole town. and I can't walk out of my house, and you certainly shouldn't come to the town after dark. I mean, that's how dangerous it is in certain places, and the parents are making a decision to say, I'm going to have to face this danger, but I don't want my child brought back to face this danger. And so they're leaving the children in the United States, and to watch them have to make this decision is really heartbreaking.
Oh, my gosh. I cannot even imagine what it would take to make a decision like that. So meanwhile, you've got children in this country, little children in some cases, who wouldn't understand a parent's decision like that, but probably, as you mentioned before, feeling the sense of being abandoned and traumatized. What happens to them, these children, if parents are saying it's too dangerous for me to try to get my child back home? I don't know if I can get asylum in the United States. I'm going to leave them there. What happens to those children?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think just to step back a second, I think one of the factors that is involved is how old the child is. I think for a lot of parents who are abroad, if the child is too young, they're asking for the child to be brought back to them. Right. I think the children that are being left in the U.S. are usually older children, so that there can be this conversation, and hopefully there's at least a distant relative in the U.S. they can live with, so they're not sent to foster care. Right. But that's a very tough decision to have with your child, and hopefully, you know, it's mainly older children, but you're absolutely right. The children are just so traumatized by this situation. I mean, we're hearing from parents that they were standing there, sometimes with handcuffs on, and the child is literally being taken away from them. The child is staring at them, you know, saying to the parents, either with their eyes or out loud, please help me, don't let them take me away. And the parent obviously is helpless to stop it, and so then the child is taken away for months and months, and the resentment builds up of, why am I here? Why did my parents let this happen to me? It's just an unbearable situation, especially with little kids watching as their parents stand there, not understanding that their parents couldn't do anything to stop it. I think that the trauma is going to be severe and potentially permanent, as you know, and you've seen the entire medical community literally come out against this practice.
That's Lee Gallant, and he's deputy director at the ACLU, the ACLU's Immigration Rights Project, and lead attorney on the family separation cases at the ACLU. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Gabby. She says, I have family members who argue that the idea that Central Americans seek asylum in the United States are abusing our immigration laws because they could easily seek asylum in other countries along the way. Is that true? Can your guests respond? Lee Gallant, do you have any response to Gabby's question?
It's not true that they can seek asylum in other places. And I think one thing people should understand is the journey that some of these people are making is so difficult that they're not making a decision lightly. And if it were easy for them to go to another country and get asylum, I think they would. It's simply not true that other countries would necessarily give them asylum. So, you know, we can't give asylum to everyone, especially people who don't, obviously there are people who don't deserve asylum, don't meet the criteria, but I think what we need to do is at least give them fair process. And one of the things I found about the family separation policy is there are a lot of people who don't agree with the ACLU on all immigration policy, especially the sort of macro immigration policy. Mm-hmm. But I think that most people in the country have said, look, this is a step too far. Wherever we ultimately come out as a country on immigration, we need to step back and say, look, that's too much to just take a child away from their parents. So, you know, hopefully we'll never see an episode like this again, the family separation policy. But, you know, there'll be debates about how much asylum we need to give, what kind of process asylum seekers need to give. But we do need to follow the law as well as international law.
And some of this involved the Flores Agreement, which said mm-hmm. that children could not be detained more than 20 days if they stayed with their parents, hence the zero tolerance policy that was in effect for a couple of months. But without that, without Flores, then could we see then more detention centers so the children might stay with their parents, but they would all be in detention together.
Right. Well, we are very troubled by what's coming out of the White House now that suggests, well, okay, we won't separate them, but we'll just indiscriminately, indefinitely detain families. That's not what should be substituted in for family separation. In this country, we should not be throwing people, including asylum seekers, into immigration. Just the ACLU's position is that, of course, children should not be detained indefinitely, but no one, including the parents, should be detained indefinitely unless they're shown through fair process to be a flight risk or a danger. I mean, what the administration seems to be contemplating is, even if the parent is not a flight risk or a danger and is applying for asylum, we're still going to hold them in these detention centers. We believe that's unconstitutional. It also makes no sense economically because it costs a fortune to detain these families. And if they're not a flight risk and will show up for their hearings and cause no problems while they're waiting for their asylum hearings, we need to be releasing them.
I'm sure you've heard the argument that, well, these people could just, we're a big country, people could disappear inside the country and never come back to an asylum hearing and essentially become part of the underground economy or pretend that they're Americans.
Right. And so we certainly hear that, and I think it's an important point for us to address. What the Obama administration did at the end of the second term was come up with this program, the Case Management Program, that was assuring appearance at roughly a 97-98% clip. And so there are many ways that we've now devised to assure appearance, and the most drastic of them is ankle bracelets. But we can assure appearance without putting people in detention. So, and people have a vested interest in showing up for their hearings if they're going to get asylum. It's very, very hard on people to live in the shadows without any status. And if they have asylum claims, they're going to come for their hearings because if they are granted asylum, that's a path to forward and so for permanently stay in the United States. So there are true tested ways to assure appearance. I don't think we need to indiscriminately detain everyone.
Almost out of time here. Does asylum lead to citizenship, or is that another, once you get asylum, is it then the next hurdle would be citizenship?
Then you'd have to become a lawful permanent resident first. So there's a few steps before you become a citizen.
Is this hard work for you?
For me?
Yeah.
It's been, you know, a long process, but it's certainly nothing compared to what the families. I mean, that's needless to say.
Sure.
We have been very busy. I think everyone who does this work now has been busy because the administration has really made immigrants the target, maybe more than any other group in the United States. And every day they are trying to do something else that we believe hurts immigrants. And so there is just a lot of battles to fight. And unfortunately, I don't see them stopping in the future.
But that's where we see the courts stepping in, correct?
Exactly. And so the administration is doing everything they can to make it hard on immigrant communities. And I think anybody who thinks, well, they're just going after hardened criminals or national security threats, that's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. They're going through after families who have maybe overstayed a visa, have no criminal record, have been contributing to society. And we also haven't seen much from Congress, obviously. So the courts are playing their role as a last resort and doing so well, and so we need to bring court cases. But at the end of the day, none of these court cases can really achieve significant gains unless there's public outrage. And I think that's why this family separation lawsuit was so successful, is that we were in court, but really what happened was the public pushed back, and not just Democrats and liberals,
I hate
but conservatives and Republicans.
Sure. Hate to do this to you. We are out of time. Lee Galern, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Deputy Director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.